Okay, this is Rhys Williams, and I'm here talking to M. John Harrison, and good to have you here with us, Mike.
Hi there.
It's good to see you. Mike is here with us today because tomorrow at Warwick University there is a conference on his work, Irradiating the Object, and I guess to start off, I was just wondering how you feel about academic attention to your work, Mike, if you read many critical pieces or if you engage with that kind of thing.
I don't read a lot of academic criticism. I read a fair amount of theory in the early 80s, late 70s and early 80s, simply to get a grounding in what was happening then.
Mm.
But I wouldn't think of myself as in any way academic or in any way even capable, as it were, of having a theory about what I do or indeed about what anybody else does.
Oh, I've read some of your blog posts that would disagree with that, perhaps.
Well,
you're certainly opinionated.
Yeah, well, absolutely. I think we have to be careful to make a distinction between being opinionated and having necessarily a worked out and, as it were, worthwhile. A lot of my blog posts are pure rant. What I do think about all of this is that as far as the author in the street is concerned, you should be able to say fairly clearly and in a reasonably sophisticated fashion what you think about writing and how it does what it does. You should be able to do that.
Mm.
Otherwise, I'm not quite sure why you're being a writer in the first place. Having said that, I was brought up in a completely different tradition, which was that of popular fiction, and it was dinned into my head quite early, you know, at the age of 20, 22, that popular fiction was not written to be analysed, although it might be analysed, it might even be worth analysing. But that essentially our job was to, I guess, to entertain, and that could be done by learning the craft and by learning the techniques. I immediately became rather rebellious about that, simply because it had been put to me that I had to do it, which is like a red rag to a bull to me, basically. But I do think that there are skills and formal skills and a knowledge of form which really good, crisp popular fiction. And I don't necessarily mean the popular fiction of today. good, crisp popular fiction has, that you don't find necessarily in literary fiction, although you often do, in fact, find it in literature, which is a different kettle of fish altogether. So for me, at the beginning, my models would have been guys like Alfred Bester and Robert Silverberg, rather than... I was going to say rather than literary writers, but that's not true because I had plenty of models.
Would you say that writing is a means of achieving an end, I suppose, and you have to use the right tools?
Yeah. Well, or you have to adapt whatever you find that suits your personality, I think, really, in the end, because so much of it comes down to voice. So much of it is your own voice. So much of it is, you hope, what's going inside your own head. That you really do need to, you need to make a fairly individualistic machine to do the job. So for me, there was a big input from popular writers, very skillful, very technical popular writers, but there was also a huge input from writers from a completely different tradition, Flann O'Brien, Samuel Beckett, T.S. Eliot, all the people who knocked my head out, you know. And also modern, as it were, contemporary novelists at the time, early postmodernists like Thomas Pynchon, writers like Ballard, obviously, since Jimmy Ballard was just down the road from me, as it were, in the metaphorical sense. We shared some of the same space very occasionally. Then... obviously, he was a big influence too. So for me, I don't have a tradition of thinking of my writing as being analysable academically. So I'm a bit anxious. And I'm certainly very flattered because, you know, the idea is to put enough in there for it to be fun to be extracted, you know.
I remember reading somewhere you said, I can't remember who the literary model was, the author that you were talking about, but you said you learned from someone the technique of implying depth through the surface of the text.
Yeah, that'd be Catherine Mansfield, or actually any early sort of proto-modernist. That was my big discovery in the late 70s when I was kind of in complete reaction against everything I've just talked about, the whole idea of craft and technique. I suddenly realised that essentially when you talked about that, you had to talk about the context as well, and you had to talk about the fact that you were producing product and that a product had a context and that it was designed to do something and that everything wasn't designed to do the same thing, that you might do other things. And certainly Mansfield was a huge introduction, along with Chekhov, say, and all sorts of lesser-known people like Dorothy Williams. All those early sort of everybody in Britain at the time, certainly who was tinkering with modernism and trying to take it out of being so perhaps so experimental and actually use it in the field. It was like field postmodernism, Elizabeth Bowen, people like that. I suddenly realised that you could make completely different areas of the text speak, that it wasn't to do with... We had two gods, plot and narrative drive. But there are lots of other ways of conveying things in fiction.
Sure.
And as soon as you begin to use them, you begin to your ability to convey, but your scope increases vastly.
Yeah.
The things that you can convey.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, broaden out. So what I sort of looked for was a way of uniting those two traditions, or not uniting them so much as colliding them, you know, as hard as possible, and see what flew off, and see how I could use that to build something that would be me, you know?
I would wonder what you would think. It seems, looking at the way that your writing has changed, I suppose, over the years, and as particularly in the way that you fairly quickly, you know, break with and move away from, I guess, the more traditional science fictional tropes, which are perhaps, the way that you're talking now, perhaps are slightly constraining in terms of not being able to do the job that you want them to do.
Or that they limit the job you can do.
Okay. And I was wondering, but it seems, this is an incredibly general way of putting it, but it seems like a movement into a better expression of subjective experience, which is perhaps unavailable to the kind of standard, you know, sci-fi generic. I mean, it's the kind of new wave stuff as well, right? I mean, this is inner space, really looking to express those kinds of things. And I feel like, I would ask you the question, what do you think, if that's what the struggle perhaps was partly about, was this, you know, this insufficiency, I suppose, in the genres to really grapple with that stuff, which obviously modernism is very good at, right?
Yes, yeah. That's what I felt, certainly. I came to it quite late. I hadn't quite realised what the new wave was up to while I was a member of it. I was so busy hoeing my own row, I wasn't actually entirely sure what anybody else was doing at the time. But yes, it became for me, in say the late 70s and early 80s, it was a matter of not just conveying subjectivity, it was a matter of finding one. It was a matter of finding a subjectivity which I could label as an identity, i.e., you know, me, Mike Harrison. And it first sent me off... it sent me off in two simultaneous directions. One was the heavy modification of traditional fantasy and SF tropes, which you would get, say, in something like the later Viriconium stories.
Really good. I love that story.
That was the point at which I began to deliberately apply modernism and postmodernism mm-hmm. to typical fantasy, you know, setups, as it were, to see what happened.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's still very lively. You read it now and you think, wow, yeah, it kind of worked, that. The other direction was to go all the way down the road that Catherine Mansfield, Elizabeth Bowen, Elizabeth Taylor, Christopher Isherwood, all those writers that had suddenly exploded in my head, and really write completely subjective stuff. Stuff that was barely fantastic.
Mm.
But, and in that, and particularly in the short fiction around that time, I was quite deliberately, I set myself quite deliberately the task to write, say, horror fiction with all the horror scraped out.
Mm. Okay.
So there's a story called The Ice Monkey.
Yeah.
Which is probably the first of those stories that was successful. And there are, in 4,000 words, there are three sentences left that tell you that something weird has happened.
Uh-huh.
The rest were there. It started 10,000 words long, and it was just cut and cut and cut and cut until I'd done that. I wrote five or six stories like that, and then Ramsey Campbell, who bought a lot of them for horror vehicles of his, wrote to me and said, "God, you're obviously so influenced by Robert Aitman." And I'm going, "Ramsey, I've never read any Robert Aitman." In fact, it turned out that, like everybody at that time, I'd read The Bells, you know, but that was the only Aitman I'd read. But as soon as Ramsey mentioned him, I began to read him and began to realise that if you do what I was doing, which is to try and scrape all the fantasy out of a fantasy, or all the horror out of a horror short story,
yeah,
what you end up with is very like Robert Aitman. But so those were the two kind of pathways. One of them ended up with Climbers, which is a completely mainstream novel, as it were. And the other path moved through the course of the heart and novels and short stories of that type until it came back and met the other one.
Mm.
My idea was always to bring them together again.
Mm.
So that eventually you would have all these postmodern adventures with genre tropes, and you would have all these subjective modernist adventures with identity and personality and people.
Mm.
Which seemed to me to be remarkably important. Science fiction cannot, even now, do people. It doesn't do people.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, you've got Ursula Guin's famous Mrs. Brown talk, right? Where she says, you know, there's only like three characters that she thinks of as actual characters in science fiction.
Yeah. Then we're not good at it. I felt that was a terrific limitation. And basically you could, a lot of those really good sci-fi effects, those good fantasy effects, those good horror effects, you can get them even better if you can do character.
Yeah.
You know, you can make them stick. You can make them hurt more.
Yeah.
At the reception end, reader end, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, because you're invested, I suppose, in the characters by that point, rather than just, you know, stock characters.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that's interesting. I was wondering, what do you think? Well, you just mentioned the continuing inability, should we say, of science fiction to do characters. It's a bold statement. But what do you think of, I guess, the kind of state of science fiction today, I suppose? Because obviously you have people like, China Mayville is a very obvious one, your new work, things which aren't exactly science fiction, but which blend, I think. There seems to be a lot more diffusion between the genres now. Like Kelly Link is a very interesting one.
Yeah, absolutely.
Steph Swainston. I mean, you know all of these people, I'm sure.
Nina Allen. Yeah.
And I just, what's your kind of take on that, I suppose? Because it's interesting to me that you, as you say, started with the kind of new wave and, you know, almost too early to even really know what was happening with the new wave. And now, at least since the 2000s, it feels like there's another new wave of some kind, right? Or at least a push towards...
I think there has been. I think there have been several different attempts to kind of name it and claim it.
Mm.
And make definitions and all to the good. But that none of them have quite grasped it, because it's a real event. It's not a move. It's never been a literary movement. Things are too spread out now for that to happen. In the old days, you needed a magazine. Yeah. You needed a strong editor. You needed strong polemics. You had a view of, you had a centralist view of how that kind of change or shift could come about, how pressure could be brought to bear. It doesn't work like that anymore. Everything is much more diffuse. But I think that there is absolutely no doubt that it's been happening, as you say, since the late 90s. And all to the good.
Yeah, no, I mean, I agree very much. It's interesting, isn't it? I mean, you've spoken before about your desire to have, I think it was actually on the large blog argument over the term New Weird, which is probably one of the most read literary blog arguments ever. I spent a fascinating couple of days making my way through it. And in that, I think it was in that, you said, you know, you spoke of your desire to have this kind of melting pot of literature. And by that, I took you to mean, you know, genre, literature with a big L, you know, everything. You know, why should there be different standards, I suppose? Do you still feel like that? Do you think it's kind of happening?
That's always been my call. I mean, I still think that's a great way to put it. Why should there be different standards? You know, really, it comes back to the idea of not being able to do character. There's lots of other things we can't do or couldn't do. Actually, a lot of those are changing. There are some very good writers among these. But you know, you mentioned Kelly Link.
Yeah.
Very good writer.
Yeah.
Previously, fantasy of that kind couldn't do prose. Now it can. It can do prose as well as or better than Litfic. They had better watch out, you know, as far as that kind of thing is concerned, because writers like Kelly Link, Nina Allen are coming for them. You know,
yeah, I mean,
Karen Russell, you know, all of these people, they're very good writers, and that's, you know, that's so delicious to me.
I guess what I want to kind of pin you down on a bit more is it's clear that there are authors in the kind of genres who, like you say, are able to do, you know, what Litfic pretends it's the only thing that can do, right? So they're coming at the border from that side. What is it that, but it seems to me that they're improving by taking techniques or abilities from lit fiction, I guess, right? And what is it about fantasy or genre fiction, in your opinion, which Litfic can't do, which Litfic struggles with? Because there is a sense there of, you know, if genre fiction is just kind of beefing itself up in some sense, then what's Litfic going to take from it? I mean, obviously there are examples like Cloud Atlas is a kind of mainstream literary novel, which is very science fictional. So they are stealing our tropes. But I'm just wondering why you think that is. What's the?
I'm not sure they're stealing our tropes anymore. what's happened? For various reasons, some of which I think are solely to do with the economics and trade, is that whether we like it or not, or they like it or not, this has become shared ground because it is a way of getting readers. Publishers are extremely interested in litfic writers who might spread themselves around a little in that way. That gives an economic reason for writers of that type to do these kinds of things. Meanwhile, we have our own reasons for poaching on their territory. Actually, I think all these metaphors of poaching and nicking one another's tropes, we've got to stop that. You know, you can't really have a melting pot if you use terminology like
sure.
that.
Yeah, absolutely.
The same as if you use the terminology of borders, which are transgressed, for instance.
Yeah.
I would much prefer to talk of sort of heavily graded liminalities
Sure. You know, yeah, a spectrum, essentially.
And furthermore, somewhere in the middle of all that, an absolute broth, a real broth, which might be offensive, even.
Okay.
In its brothiness.
Yeah.
You know?
Too much of everything.
Too much of everything. Too wild. Too imaginative.
Wow.
Too unconstrained.
I can't wait to read this person.
And yet at the same time written with absolute... Well, you already have if you read any Flann O'Brien, you know? this is what we should be aiming for. Or if you read any Kenneth Patchen or any of these those guys.
My reading list is getting longer by the minute.
I forget what we were. I forget what the question was.
I guess, really simply, what is it that genre fiction does that, you know, litfic can't do in some sense? Like, why would they need the techniques of genre fiction? What is it that sci-fi can do?
It's better at making metaphors.
Mm.
It's better at making metaphors, partly because of an assumption that it makes, which is a false assumption, I think.
Okay.
And here I am steering heavily against the tide. This idea that science fiction is not metaphor,
mm-hmm.
that it's not supposed to be regarded as metaphor,
mm-hmm.
I think that is, in fact, to use a technical term, bollocks.
Okay.
But actually, what science fiction and fantasy are so good at, because they stem in the end from the imagination. Science fiction doesn't stem from science.
Mm.
You know, it stems from exactly the same place of fantasy. Sorry, but it does.
Absolutely, yeah.
The imagination.
I'm on your side then.
You know, because of that, we can make the material for metaphors quicker and easier than they can.
Mm.
And we're used to it. You know, science fiction writers, God bless their cotton socks, are so used to reading a science magazine and going, oh, wow, I can use that.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
The other day I saw in The Guardian, and I will name no names, mainly because I've forgotten them.
Okay. Good.
I saw a description, a supposedly theoretical description, a model of the relationship between literary fiction and the genres.
Okay.
By a literary fiction writer,
right.
Who, as I say, I will name no names because I've forgotten anyway who it was. The model, I kid you not, was that of a bicycle wheel. The model of that incredibly complex relationship between genres, each other, and what was conceived of as a hub.
Mm.
You know?
Yeah.
And I immediately thought, well, that's rubbish. Okay, that's very, very clearly rubbish. In the comments below the line, somebody said, I think that's rubbish. What we need is a much more flexible novel. A family tree. And you can imagine me sitting there. I've had three espressos. It's 9 o'clock in the morning and my head is going... ba-dum, ba-dum, ba-dum. Because any science fiction writer would have 10... absolutely up-to-the-minute ways of arguing with that model,
mm-hmm.
all based on other models of other types of organisation.
Sure, yeah.
You know?
Uh-huh.
Where was the reference to emergence?
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Where was the reference to self-organisation? I looked, but I could not find the term complexity theory, you know? That's what science fiction can do. It can make metaphors. It makes them quicker and faster than litfic can do.
Yeah, I think that's...
You know?
Yeah, because it draws them from... I mean, you know, if you imagine humans as, you know, metaphor-producing machines in some sense, there's a wide variety of different places you can make metaphors from, right? The sciences is a really obvious and productive one, of course. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. That's interesting. A bicycle wheel. So, essentially, they had mimetic realism in the hub, in some sense, right?
There was an argument that somehow the hub took in what it wanted and down the spokes and verified it and sent it back out.
So what, it's just the best-selling literature then? Or how is it graded as best?
I do not know. It looked to me like a form of organisation which even the military has abandoned. Even the UK military has abandoned the idea of a hub so that, you know, whenever the exterior needs to move, the circumference needs to make a decision, mm-hmm. a message has to go back to the hub and come back out to the circumference yeah. again. You know, no mention was made in this article of a 100% connectivity net, you know, which even the military uses now. It's like this was not based on lots of fast, flexible thinking about organisation.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, it sounds like a model designed by someone who would design that model, right?
To put it bluntly. I'm afraid so, yes. Yes.
Who puts, yeah, Litvic in the centre of the world.
And I am going to write a blog piece about it eventually, which will finish by describing the bicycle. Because it will be that kind of sit-up-and-beg bicycle, which you would hear rattling along the cobbles of those hallowed Oxbridge halls. You know?
I look forward to that one. Right, okay. So where did we get to with that? The melting pot of literature.
That was the melting pot, yeah.
Okay. Yeah, better at making metaphors, absolutely. For that reason then, to make a terrible segue, you've spoken before, I think, a few times about, well, earlier, just now, about how you scrape the fantasy out of your literature. And I think somewhere I read you talking about trying to find the reality at the heart of the fantasy. So I guess this idea of coming back to reality through this kind of apparently non-realistic kind of technique, right? And particularly after having read your latest, trilogy, the Kefuhuchi Tract trilogy, I was just wondering, this is a really difficult question, I think, or maybe it's just banal, but what is your idea of this kind of reality that you want to keep coming back to? Because especially in the Kefuhuchi Tract trilogy, it's as if fantasy or not taking reality seriously or trying to ignore or escape or run away from reality is very frowned upon, right? I mean, okay, it's ambiguous, it's complex, but it seems to be frowned upon. What is your idea of facing up to reality, I suppose? What is that?
In this context, mm-hmm. you know, in the context where we are, what we're talking about now, I think you have to assume that you have to start by making an assumption about fictional discourse, which is that it's precisely that, fictional. Mm-hmm. It's not therefore real. You can only define it in opposition to what is, whatever that is. Mm. So you've already got a system with two bits,
sure. yeah.
which move against one another. So that every time you write a fantasy, be it a horror story set now, in which the characters are real, recognisable, mimetically produced people mm-hmm. with very recognisable concerns mm-hmm. And so on, or whether it's a completely wild fantasy, which is what the Light trilogy is. Mm-hmm. I don't believe it to be science fiction. So it's a kind of postmodern fantasy with all the stops pulled out.
Yeah.
Every story, then, is this machine which, because it has these two parts, that which is fictional set up against that which is not fictional.
Okay.
It also has, I find this really hard to say, you can balance that fictionality against the non-fictionality of the reader and the reader's situation while they're reading, which you see as the world. I would define that as the world.
Okay.
So what I'm constantly trying to do is to take the reader to the edge of a fantastic experience. Particularly, it's often a world. I often take the reader deep into the liminality between the reader's world and a fictional world. Mm-hmm. And then just as they're beginning to fall over into that swan dive into the fiction mm-hmm. and the comfort, perhaps, of the fiction, uh-huh. the comfort of the escapism, I make the fiction bite them.
Uh-huh. And that's the reality.
And that serves to remind them that they're still a human being sitting in a chair mm-hmm. And that they've still got to pay the rent and do that stuff. Uh-huh. And that, you know, they still have arthritis, as it were, or whatever. That's one of the unfair things that I do.
Uh-huh.
And I do often do that by refusing closure. And it's very simple to do, even in... It's not a way of specifically biting science fiction readers. You can bite any kind of reader without one, any kind of fiction reader by refusing closure, by building expectations and then not delivering from a different direction, because that's what popular fiction does, but by refusing to deliver at all. The second thing that I try to do is to ask myself what fears lie at the heart of any given fantasy. Mm. So that fantasies of immortality clearly have the fear of death,
yep,
very central to them.
Yeah.
So that if you wrote a fantasy of immortality, from my perspective, what you would do is instead of giving the reader that immortality, instead of giving them the sensation of having that immortality, instead of in the end speaking of immortality as if it could be something that for a moment could be had, what you do is, again, at the end, while you're refusing them closure, you're also saying, and by the way, this is what you're scared of.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Thank you. That was a really good answer to a very badly phrased question.
Well, no, it's difficult. It's a very difficult thing to say, because you can't say it without taking into account the reader's context, because that's where the reality is.
Mm.
The reality isn't necessarily in the work.
I guess I was wondering, as a kind of closing question, I suppose, if you wanted to talk about something that you were working on at the moment. What do you have coming up?
I was going to say I'm writing a lot of short stories at the moment, but I've written them all.
Oh.
So I can't say that. I just finished a burst of... I've written about 20,000 words of short stories in quite a short time.
Are you planning on bringing that out? I mean, you've gone to the kind of... you've experimented with the kind of...
Yes.
Kindle modelling.
I think two of them will come out as singles.
Uh-huh.
One of them is 10,000 words long, so it'll be a bit more substantial than the last Kindle that I did, which was right down at the bottom at 5,000 words, which is as small as they go. The other one will be the one that I'm going to read tomorrow. Will also be a Kindle.
Oh, brilliant! What's the title of that one?
Well, it's called, at the moment, it's called The Crisis, but I think it's been through several titles, and I think it may go through several more. The Crisis is a perfectly good title, as you'll be able to tell when you hear it. But at the same time, my titles are so boring. If I write a story about a house, I call it The House. I really should stop doing that.
Well, to be fair, Mike, if you tried to title your stories to actually capture what happened within them, I don't...
It would be as long as the stories.
It would be very difficult.
Here is the title of my story. It is also the story.
It's all part of the refusal of closure, I think.
Yes. But, so I'm doing those. I've been working on two separate novels since 2008.
Uh-huh.
And they've been through various versions. They've both been abandoned once, which is par for the course. Mm. I don't think I would ever write a novel unless I had abandoned it at some point. For a while they were in... I deliberately put them in competition with one another, because I wasn't sure which of them I really wanted to write. And I really did think that it came down to one or the other, and it has. Finally, I've kind of made the choice.
Okay.
And so I'm working on that. That will be more like, since I wanted to rest from anything that resembled light or space opera or fantasy, and I felt as if I would like to get back to reality again and write stuff with a much more mimetic, realistic background, set now. The only way you'll be able to describe this is it's a kind of horror novel.
Okay.
Which plays all sorts of games with the idea of, you know, this stuff about the human beings having at some point bred with Neanderthal.
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh.
Yeah, and with the Denisovans as well. as soon as I read that, I thought, H.P. Lovecraft. here we come. I thought, well, how can I do that? You know, how can I do a version of it which will do all the things that we've discussed here, but also be very, very, very sophisticated, i.e. how can I write something like that where I would very carefully wipe out all the major indicators that it was a horror novel.
Are you going to do Lovecraft and scrape out all of the Lovecraft?
Yes, basically. And not only that, but I'm going to scrape the tone out as well, so that you won't even have the tone as a cue.
Okay.
And in the end, probably, the only way you'll know that that's what I've been doing is because I've told you. it's set in London. I produced a huge amount of material while I was living in West London.
Mm-hmm.
I lived in West London for about 10, 12 years. I live right near the Thames, 2 minutes away from the Thames. I took my notebook out every day, produced vast amounts of material. And as I said, began trying to use it in 2008 and actually found that I couldn't really get to grips until I moved out of London. I wasn't living there anymore.
Mm.
So now I live in Shropshire and I keep saying to my partner, I'm going to have to go back to Barnes. Because I took a lot of material while I was there, but I need to check the colour of a doorway. And it's some of it's set on the river. Much of it is to do with graveyards. There will be references to Borges, as well as Lovecraft. Generally, it'd be very unpleasant.
Great, I look forward to it.
Mm.
I was wondering, actually, it's interesting to have a little insight into your writing process, because A lot of the time, obviously, I mean, like you say, you write something and then you tend to take bits out of it. I suppose that's what it sounds like. And it feels, I suppose, as an end result, it feels like it was composed in a very kind of fragmentary way. I don't know if that is actually how you go about doing it.
Absolutely.
Often things get pulled from different stories into...
Yeah. One of my other kind of theoretical positions is that all writing is the same writing, in a sense, that something which makes a paragraph in one thing can stand on its own, or it can make a paragraph in another thing. A chapter, I don't see the difference between many epiphanic short stories and chapters in novels, and certainly I could do you one. I can top and tail a chapter of my own work in such a way as to turn it into an epiphanic short story in about 3 days.
You could double your output.
Yes, exactly. This goes back to the technique school, you know, when I was 20. This goes back to that horrible facility that professional writers have got with stuff, you know.
It's good to have that mastery, I suppose, over your materials.
I wouldn't call it a mastery. In the end, the material always masters me. But, you know, I try. I do my best to fight the good fight. But so some of that fragmentary nature, that sense you have of it being staccato and oddly structured is deliberate. And it's partly from use of that technique, and it's partly from a conscious awareness that you're using that technique. Again, anything that trips the reader up is a good thing as far as I'm concerned.
I mean, just to ask then, in that case, you've spoken a lot about that, tripping the reader up, biting them with the reality. And I feel like this is possibly a question you've answered too many times, but what is it about fantasy, or particularly the escapism that fantasy offers, that riles you up so much?
I really find it hard to answer that at this point in time, for the simple reason that when it first began to rile me, that was 30 or 40 years ago.
Okay, yeah, it's a long time to be riled.
And it riled me for different reasons than the reasons it riles me now. Yeah? The reason it riles me now is that we live in a fantasy. I have watched and I've had personal experience of brands and corporates very deliberately getting involved with fantasy mm-hmm. and fantasy imagery,
mm-hmm.
Hiring writers to talk to brand managers Absolutely. About how to get some fantasy into their brand. At the same time, a lot of Western life since the Second World War, since the recovery from the Second World War, has been a fantasy. The idea of being able to go out of your house, get into a car that will do 150 miles an hour, and feel entitled to be able to go on a road and do that, seems to me to be a massive fantasy.
Mm.
It's a fantasy because actually you can't.
Mm.
Not without getting arrested.
Yeah, absolutely.
You can't, because if you try to do it, say, at this time of year, you will be instantly caught in a traffic jam. You could own the fastest Porsche there is, and mm-hmm. it will not help you if you're in a traffic jam. But it's also another kind. It's also another kind of fantasy. If you ask, apparently, and I've seen this, seen the statistics on this. If you ask motorists how they grade themselves in terms of the percentage of the whole, how good they are,
okay,
they will all put themselves in the top 10%.
Really?
Yeah.
Top 10.
So we all have a fantasy of being top in the top 10% of drivers.
Mm.
Think what that means at 80 miles an hour in the third lane.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, I've always thought motorways are an incredible trust exercise, frankly.
Absolutely. Now advertisers play with that, and they fictionalise that fantasy of escape, of
mm-hmm. Sure.
of being able to get in a car and become free and be younger
mm-hmm.
than we are. Be free of our marriage and our children, and so on and so forth. That to me is fantasy writing.
Mm.
Another version of it is the whole thing of you deserve it,
yeah.
you're worth it.
Yeah.
L'Oreal.
A big theme in
yeah.
the Cavucci structure.
Yeah, absolutely. This whole idea that somehow we're all the centre of the world.
Mm-hmm.
I find that now more devastatingly escapist and fantastic than any amount of Harry Potter.
Mm-hmm.
To be frank, she's done well with Harry Potter. She sold a few billion books and she's made a bit of money.
Yeah.
But she has made nothing like the money or the sales of Coca-Cola.
No.
A fantasy brand, if ever there was one.
Yeah, of course, yeah. Yeah, there's the famous metaphor from your claimers, right?
Exactly. Or L'Oreal, for that matter.
Mm.
You know? L'Oreal gives you, what is it? You're worth it.
Mm-hmm.
Three words. Three words to build a fantasy which has made literally billions of money. That puts poor old Rowling in the shade.
Absolutely.
That puts any fantasy writer in the shade.
But it appeals, like you say, to its exact opposite fear in people, right?
Oh, yeah.
That you're not worth it.
Yeah.
And because you're not worth it, you have to doll yourself up and, you know, or
absolutely.
Make yourself younger or
yeah.
what have you.
Absolutely.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely fascinating. I think the thing that really gets me, it kind of goes back to the reality question that I asked you earlier, is that I really get an impression from your books that at least one aspect of what you consider to be real is an actual genuine engagement with other people, I suppose. A kind of recognition of the fact that we're all bound to each other, that there is this kind of community of humans, and you know, all of the different fantasies of escape, of freedom, of being the centre of the world, all of these are highly individualistic and damaging as a result, because you forget that you're part of this web,
mm.
you know, of this kind of interconnection. And you know, in the extremes, you have, you know, our kind of gas-guzzling fantasy life in Britain costing, you know, lives in Africa. I mean, this is the kind of larger picture,
yeah.
obviously.
Yeah.
So I think people, I guess, I feel like people are very important to you.
Yeah. Having said that,
which is a man, it's important to everyone, I think.
But if, that the solution is, as you say, to live a life in the world with people directly, and to somehow, I was going to say recover, I know that would be a dangerous word these days, we're not supposed to look backward, as it were, but to recoup some sense of a life in which it's genuinely significant that you cut your finger and feel something, and that somebody else says, oh no, you've cut your finger, we can sort this, don't worry, you know. A life in which people are together. However, I never show that. That would be consolation. It would be consoling to show that. I always produce the most barren, alienated world that I possibly can, because I want to shock people into the recognition that, you know, here it is. Here's the end product of L'Oréal.
Yeah.
It's in these books. It's going to happen 400 years' time. This is what it's going to be like. Furthermore, you know, I don't mind if people throw my book away. Throw it into a bin, go home and hug the kids. You know? Because you do not want this happening to you. In a sense, I'm more interested in a way in showing the horrific results of alienation than I am pointing to what we ought to have.
Yeah, well, the utopia in the Kefahuchi tract, I mean, I felt like there was two, I don't know what you think about that, Ed, obviously, which is really, you know, unimaginable, and charismatic is a word that gets used. And just completely distant, I think, from any kind of human reality, right? One of the characters says, why would I do that to myself, Ed? Fat Tony,
yes.
I think his name is.
Fat Antoine.
Fat Antoine, yeah. But then there is another kind of hint, I think, which I connects to this people thing. Edith and Marnie, the two daughters, they have a kind of mundane utopianism to them, I think. They seem to... I think the book seems to privilege the way that they face reality, you know, head on. They seem to kind of...
Marnie particularly,
yeah, absolutely. They seem to accept their own limitations, you know, the limitations of the world, and just kind of get on with it in some sense.
I think in a sense that her mother is yearning towards that and failing because she's one of us.
Anna, yeah.
Yeah, Anna is, you know, the total L'Oréal woman. But somehow desperate to humanise herself before the end, before the end of it, you know, which she, maybe she does, maybe she doesn't, who knows. Maybe the text allows her that, maybe it doesn't. But Marnie is always used as a sort of... now you've said that, I think she's possibly the only positive character in most of my entire oeuvre.
That was the impression I got, I didn't want to say it aloud.
But basically she is an extremely... She is a sort of, okay, well... I will show you, just this once, in a very short, you know, 1,000, 2,000 words. Yeah. I will show you what we ought to be doing, you know, which is getting on with it in the world and looking after the kid and trying to make things work.
But it's the density of it that works so well, I think. I mean, talking about your, you know, the machine that does a specific job for you, after three. You know, books of madness, frankly, you know, this kind of futuristic craziness, you just have right at the end. I think the only thing after it is Helen Alper, which obviously is significant in its own way, but you just have right at the end this 2-3 pages of Marnie's life condensed right down. It's so solid, it's so kind of, it's like a brick. You know?
I'm so glad. I'm so glad you received it like that, because that was absolutely the intention.
Oh, good,
you know,
okay, good.
No, absolutely the intention. I can't say it was the intention from the very start because, you know, a trilogy is a big thing and took me 10 years to put it together. But there was a point at which I saw that if you did that with Marnie's life and if you faced it again, sort of realistically, and said, look, this is what's happened. You know, the economics as we know it has collapsed. She is a single mother attempting without any fuss to sort of to live a life. And if you really did literally condense that down so that it was kind of like a potted biography, that the effect that you could get from that, you know, writerly, speaking in writerly terms, would be very powerful indeed. And then, as you say, it finishes with Helen Alpert for other reasons, you know, so that I could let her have that very last sentence, that very last cynical, ghastly sort of sentence.
To bleep him to a terrible recognition of the world as it...
As we live now. Yeah.
Yeah, it's in great last sentence.
But that was the idea of the whole last chapter, was to produce effects like that, stacked. You know, the fireman, the guy who's... He gets two sentences. He's manoeuvring the fire truck around, and he has a little argument with the doctor.
I love the big society fire truck as well.
Yes.
So...
but I thought he was a genius. I thought he was brilliant. I thought, this is a really good guy. You know, he's only in there for two sentences, but he's doing a job, and he's not messing about, and he isn't crazy, and, you know, and he came to put out a fire, and now he's puzzled because it wasn't seemed actually to have been a fire. And then the doctor, you know, the doctor is directly sort of out of Chekhov. You know, he's a very Chekhovian sort of a doctor. Very matter-of-fact, very positive, very... that whole last chapter was to try and produce a... to try not to evade the point, as it were. To say, well, yeah, you know, I know what this is. This is a brick of madness, as you say. You know, I don't know how many words there are there, but there are a lot. And it makes a very fat book if you put it in one volume. And it's all mad until that last sort of eight pages.
Yeah.
And the idea was to say, well, okay, you know, here's something that isn't that.
Well, it worked. For me, it worked. Right, I think that is about all we have time for.
That's a lot. I think you've got a lot.
I think we've actually overrun our time. Yeah. So, thank you very much for talking to me, Mike. And I hope the conference goes well tomorrow.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.